Hello and welcome to Reconnect. This is your host, Barry Phillips. I am so glad to spend these next 25 minutes with you, and hopefully we can find some things to grow with together. This is my effort to reach out to those that are standing in the corner. If by some means you are finding yourself alone and wishing you had other folks to walk with, this program is an effort on my part to reach out to you, take you by the hand, and say, hey, let's walk together. If you would like to reach me, you can do so. You can do it at one of a couple of ways. You can go to my website, which is Remnant of Israel, Y-I-S-R-A-E-L, remnantofisrael.com, and go to the contact page and send me an email. Or you can simply just email me directly at houseofdavid, V as in Victor, A as in Adam, houseofdavidva@yahoo.com. And I'd love to hear from you. If you have questions, comments about the programming, prayer needs, concerns, questions, I'm here to try to help. And I'm glad to try to do so. For the next foreseeable future, for the next little while, I'd like to share with you, it's going to have to be in segments due to the time constraints of the programming, but I'd like to share with you a message that I did this past Shabbat in House of David. And I am currently teaching through the book of Yochanan, John. And we are about 48 weeks into this study. So we started last year and we're continuing into this year. And so far we've gotten to chapter number 13. This is a very powerful chapter. And last week, I taught the first 17 verses. Now, I'm not going to be able to do that this week on this program, but I'd like to venture into the beginning of this, and there are several things that I'd like to share with you. I got a lot of favorable response from our congregation in House of David, a lot of urging. This needs to be made public. So I am going to try to do that. Now, let's just begin by reading the first several verses together in Yochanan, or John chapter number 13. And let's begin with verse number 1. It says, "And before the festival of the Pesach, Yeshua, knowing that his hour had come, that he should move out of this world unto the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And supper taking place, the devil having already put it into the heart of Yehuda from Kirioth, son of Shimon, to deliver him up, Yeshua, knowing that the Father had given all into his hands and that he had come from Elohim and was going to Elohim, rose from supper and laid aside his garments, and having taken a towel, he girded himself." Wow. So much is being said just in the beginning here. There's a lot of clauses that appear in the English translation that seek to describe and set the scene as to what the foundational understanding of this action that Yeshua undertakes of laying aside his outer garments and girding himself with that wardrobe of a servant. And he is going to proceed to wash his Talmudim, or his followers' feet. So, there's a lot being said here. A lot of things are already established and settled in the mind of Yeshua before he takes on this activity. And it seems to be suggesting to some degree why he is taking on this activity. So let's break all of this down and take a look at what's being communicated to us here. First of all, understand that immediately we are given the time stamp that it is the time of the Pesach. Now, I'm not going to spend any time here going through the debate that tries to determine exactly what night it was that Yeshua held this Pesach meal. I will just suffice to say that there is one school of thought. Not necessarily the right one, it's just a school of thought, okay? Think with me. And that is that from the writings that were given to Moshe, that on the night of the 13th of Aviv, you take the lamb and it's to be slaughtered in between the evenings. Now, you and I would think in between the evenings is twilight, just prior to dark. Actually, in the Hebraic concept of this, from what I've read and what I understand here, is that after the hour of noon, midday, whenever the sun begins to decline and head toward the horizon, any time in those hours, that is in between the evenings. So sometime during the afternoon hours, the Pesach lamb is slaughtered, prepared, and then eaten as night comes on the 14th. There are those who say that that's what was given to Moshe, that it's only after, during and then after the Babylonian captivity that Pesach became synonymous with and beginning at the same time with the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which means that the lamb would have been slaughtered on the 14th and consumed in the evening of the 14th going into the 15th. It's arguable. We weren't there. I don't know exactly personally how it transpired. Everybody's going to have an opinion. Wonderful. Opinions are wonderful. I just, you know, I'm not going to argue with anyone. You're welcome to all the opinions that you have. Suffice it to say, it's Pesach. And as Pesach has come, this is about the offering of Yeshua of himself as the Lamb of Elohim. As Yochanan the Immerser announced back in chapter 1 and in verse 29, behold the Lamb of Elohim who, quote, takes away the sin of the world, unquote. So Yeshua was completely mindful that his hour had come. Folks, this is it. This is the time. This is the moment. We're not talking about any further going on of more ministry or more opportunities to accomplish a miracle campaign. We're not going to any other cities. This is winding down. We're in Jerusalem, and my hour has come. One text says that he sets his face like flint toward Jerusalem. He is determined. He is embracing the fulfilling of his Father's will, and the desire is sending him to walk among us as the Lamb. His desire has been to be the Lamb all along. So his suffering and his death is but countable hours away. And yet what's on his mind is not, how am I going to endure this? How bad is this going to hurt? Father, give me strength just to get through this. But rather, it's on demonstrating passion, love, and covenant to these 12 men. He has walked with them for now some 3+ years. He's heard their arguments. He's seen their frailties. He's taught them. He has groomed them. He has poured himself into them. They have helped him. They have heard him. They have seen him at his worst and his best. And now one of the last things that he's wanting to do is to show his love for these men. When he found them, they were about whatever the business was of the family or whatever their occupation was. Some were fishermen. Matthew was a tax collector. There were zealots among them. There were those that had a variety of jobs, but they left everything to come and to follow after Messiah. There's a lesson to be learned here. Years ago, when I was a pastor, we went through long hours of pastoral training about growth, how to grow your church. And so I went through a large stack of books and writers and those that were thinkers along this edge of developing church growth trends, casting vision, building a vision team, prayer teams, on and on and on it went. One of the authors that we read quite a bit about and learned from was John Maxwell. John Maxwell has taught a lot about leadership. And I remember that he recounted a story, and I don't remember all of the details, but I remember enough to tell you this part. And if I'm not mistaken, it was he himself that was pastoring the church. I may be wrong on that, but I believe he was. Regardless, the scene is the foyer of a large church. It's filled with people. They're talking, they're milling around, they're socializing together. And the pastor, whether it's John or another one, is milling with the crowd. He is talking, he's saying his hellos, he's embracing, he's communicating with the crowd when a young staff member hurriedly begins to work his way through the crowd, saying, "Excuse me, pardon me, please, excuse me." And he moves through without really saying anything in the way of communication to anyone in the foyer. When he reaches a hallway, he quickly runs down the hallway and tries to get to his objective. Later on, either John or whoever the pastor was encountered the young staff member and inquired about what was it that you were after that was so important. Well, he said, there was something very important that I had to do. At that point, he was stopped. What he was told was the most important thing was his ministry. And the people that he had shoved his way through were his ministry. That there was nothing more important than the people. I got to tell you that it's easy, and maybe some in the audience today would have an idealized understanding of ministry and those who stand and teach, preach, equip, and so forth. You have this idealized mindset that they're perfect folks, that they're always congenial, they're always polite, they're normally well-dressed, they're engaging, they're happy, they're joyful, they've got it all together. I got to tell you that there are a lot of moments that I'm standing in front of a crowd that I feel like I've stepped into a zone and the teaching doesn't come out of my brain and then connect to my tongue and speak out of my mouth, but it erupts out of my spirit, and I've just opened my mouth, and it flows out. When I'm in that place, and when those moments are occurring, there is nothing that I have found, in ministry at least, any more fulfilling, or any more exciting, or engaging, or it's an overwhelming experience. There are other times that I've stood to teach, and what is first and foremost in the front of my mind is how I may feel at the moment. I may be exhausted and tired. I may be angry about a situation that happened outside of the congregational element there. I may be afraid of some outcome in this teaching. I may be intimidated to some degree by some figure or personality in the crowd and thinking, I've got some stage fright going on here because of who's in the audience, etc. There's a lot of stuff that could go on in the mind. But what is very common, and it's not just me, so please don't send cards and letters over this aspect of it. But from others that likewise that teach and stand in front of groups and crowds, if you will, as this feeling of that once everything is said and done, folks want to come up, they want to shake your hand, they want to talk to you, they want to engage you about some aspect of what you taught, they want to ask some questions, they want to engage in conversation, and oftentimes I just want to hide and go run away. Now, I don't know why that occurs. People are my business. You are my business. I get cards, letters, I get comments and emails, and I hear about people's needs and their problems. I talk to folks on the phone. I see people in my congregation. I see them in public. People are hurting. People are in pain. People have great needs. People have traumas taking place in their life. And they're reaching out desperately for help. That is my business. That's what I'm called to. But the human part of me sometimes just wants to hide. Or sometimes I'm busy. I got stuff going on. It could be my grandkids. It could be my children. It could be my wife. It could be my congregation. It could be, you know, I need to fix my truck. I've got places I've got to go. I've got something I've got to do. But what Yeshua is teaching me here, as I describe all of those elements of ministry and just life in general, never be too busy for people. Yeshua is getting ready to die. An amazingly horrific death. He is going to suffer untold agony and pain, and he knows it. He knows that they're not just going to run him through with a spear or behead him. He knows that he's going to the tree. He's talked about the fact that if I be lifted up, I will draw men to myself, signifying by what means that he was to die. He knew that agony laid ahead for him in just a few hours. But what was important to him were these 12 men. No matter what we have going on in our lives, no matter how we feel, no matter what our inward person says, I want to go run and hide. We can't hide. People need us. Now, everyone needs some time off. You need to go do something else and refresh your mind. You need to take a walk. You need a few days away. I get that. But we can never retreat and hermit ourselves away in a cave somewhere and pretend that people don't need us or that people are not genuinely in need. Even if we know that hard hours are ahead for us, we need to be focused on people. Now, let's go a step further here. Pesach's at hand, and it says that he knows that his hour is short. He's moving out of this realm into the next realm. What he's saying here is, my father's got this. When all of this is done, when all of this is accomplished, when I cry, it is finished. When my feet leave the soil of this earth, it's not over. It's phase one. And I'm moving back to the realm of my Father, but even then, the work is not done. There's intercessions, and there's prayers and petitions in behalf of those that will be left behind. And there is the waiting until the earth is made my footstool. Until death is finally conquered. Until the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of the Mashiach, the Messiah. So there is work to be done. There are things to be accomplished. But I'm moving out of this realm and into the realm that is to come. The lesson here for us is to understand that this is but phase one. Not all that we are to experience is wrapped up in this current world physical realm reality, that there is another realm available to us, and that is the realm of the Ruach HaKodesh, the realm of the Spirit. And we're talking about the coming of the kingdom and the embracing of the days that are yet to come. And then it says here that he knows that Hasatan has already put it into the heart of one of his own men. Wow. If it could have been just one of the adversaries, if it could have been one of the most obstinate of the Pharisees, if it had been one of those that were the legalist, that would have been more enduring, something that would have been able to be grasped and understood. But this was one of the 12 sitting at the meal with him. Now, let's understand something here. It says that Yochanan says that Hasatan, quote, put it into the heart of Yehuda to deliver him up, unquote. It was in his heart. This is not a sudden idea or a mysterious turn of events for Yehuda, but rather he had some kind of inclination that Hasatan could take advantage of for his own designs and his own purposes. Some centuries ago, Albert Barnes, an amazing commentator on Scripture, he said this, and I quote him, quote, the meaning of this passage is that Satan inclined the mind of Judas to do this. Satan could tempt no one unless there was some natural or depraved propensity that he could make use of. He projects objects and alluring forms fitted to that propensity, and under the influence of a strong or a corrupt inclination, the soul yields to sin, unquote. Now, what does all of that say? Hasatan was using an inclination that was already resident inside Yehuda. We know from the previous chapter, chapter 12, verse 6, that Yehuda was a thief because he put his hand in the bag and took money from the bag that he carried in their behalf. So was it the 30 pieces of silver that caused him to betray Yeshua? How much is Yeshua worth? Some estimates that I've read recently says that 30 pieces of silver would have equated to, in that day, something like $197. Wow. Is that all that Yeshua was worth? You would have thought that it was, you know, millions. It certainly is there. The price tag for Yeshua would have been astronomical. But if you and I were to have $197, let's round it up, $200. If we had $200, what would we do with that? Or some, it would, you know, pay the light bill. Or it would put gas in the vehicles for a week or two. It would really accomplish nothing extraordinary or significant for us. It would be a small blessing, at least here in this country, in our economy. $200? Is that what Yeshua was worth to him? Knowing that he was to be betrayed for such a small amount, was Yeshua insulted? Surely he can do better than that. Surely I'm worth more than that. How valuable is Yeshua to us? What would we trade him for? For some of us, it's an idea. It's a fleeting moment. It's a thrill. It's a fling. It's the idea that we can go to the land. I'll trade Yeshua for the concept of living in the land. It's a doctrine. It's the company that I keep. It's the approval of man. How much is Yeshua really, really worth to you? For Yehuda, it was 30 pieces of silver. And next week, we'll talk more about the significance of that amount of money. But I tell you, his price is far beyond all the wealth of the world. And there is nothing, no one, no accomplishment worthy of trading away Yeshua. More on this next week. We're going to dive in a little bit deeper. Until then, shalom. This is Barry with Reconnect.